The next two poems I'd like to talk about are The Stygian Depths of You and I and All, and Why Do Living Things Bury Themselves, because I feel like I need to answer for those. I'd like to take you through just a couple of things about Stygian Depths that influence the poem, because it's basically kind of like I was talking about before, the gumbo in my head, where I read these things and I stir them into the pot, and out sometimes comes these strange concoctions. And part of this is this, as I take you through the poem. I won't, on either of these poems, I won't put the remaining one of you to sleep that I have with a, you know, a great number of footnotes, but I do want to give you just some things to deal with, especially on Stygian here. In the first stanza, where it says, "We stand upon the shore and offer up mistletoe, rumored to give safe passage across the sea of empty space that makes up everything and everything." Basically, that comes from an idea that we are, all matter is, mostly empty space. I think the example was that if you had the nucleus of an atom, and this is a little bit of physics here, but stay with me. If you had the nucleus of an atom that it was the size of a pea, then the atom would be as wide as a football field. So you have all of that space out, you know, between the pea and the football field. That's just there. So if you think about, you know, this desk that my microphone is sitting on, it's mostly just space when you get down to the subatomic level. And I thought that was just a fascinating idea, that it's almost like between the wall of the outside of you and the essence of you is this, well, moat, for lack of a better term, just this space that that exists between us and, not just us and other people, but us and the where we end and the rest of everything else begins, if that makes any sense. And in the second stanza, our merest pieces exist on the fringes of existence. Particles with our signature have touched the vast faces of forgotten worlds, but the dog still has not been fed. Again, another idea from physics, just to show where all of this stuff comes from, you know, subscribing, you know, too long to Scientific American and MIT Review. Einstein said that God does not play dice with the universe, but there was a gentleman by the name of Heisenberg who had this lovely uncertainty principle, and he said that based upon that and some other things, there actually, you could calculate odds that, you know, instead of sitting there listening to me speak right now, you could suddenly find yourself, you know, sitting on a beach in Haiti. Like, you just spontaneously teleport there. You could, from what I understand, you could actually calculate odds that that would happen. Now, the lifespan of the universe is not long enough for that to probably actually happen in, but the odds are there. So it's just, it's the whole idea of, you know, you get down to the quantum scale and anything can happen. So it's just this idea that although we're here, pieces of us just could be anywhere at any given time. But even with that idea, just that cosmic reverie of, oh, I'm spreading out across the, you know, you've still forgotten to feed the dog. It's that mundane grounding type of thing that, you know, you can be as karmic and cosmic as you want to be, but, you know, you're still stupid in some respects. And that's the idea that I talk about through the poem of patterns. You know, the pattern for me is to be sitting here right now at this microphone, speaking to you, and your pattern is there as well, you know, listening to me. And it's a pattern because that's just what we recognize, like anything else. Because the whole thing about dust that it talks about, the remnants that you wipe off the bookshelf, you know, dust, which not only is made up of, you know, pieces of clothing and carpet in your home and just bits of stuff, I mean, you know, eventually it's you. Eventually we all become dust, which goes into something that, what is this? Counting, it's a basic skill. The fifth stanza, give me 7 years. The give me 7 years, that's actually a reference to the fact that 7 years is the longest period of time before your body has completely replaced itself. I mean, bones, skin cells, stomach, everything. You are a different person, but I still recognize the pattern that is you because it is a familiar thing to me, even though you are a completely different person. This constant state of not necessarily quantum flux, but just flux that we're all in, that we're constantly changing. Even, you know, personality-wise, we're maturing, we're growing, but also even down on the cellular level, we are constantly in a state of flux. That's the 7 years bit. And then the whole resolution of the poem about, you know, the minute levels, talking about, you know, exchanges on minute levels bordering on the cosmic and cataclysmic, you know, the smallest to the largest, which I guess would be an extension of chaos theory. The book by James Gleick, Chaos, which I had read and understood maybe three words in five, but still it was there. And the end of the poem where it says, we are all empty space in the end, all of it, all of us stuffed with fear and misgivings. And the idea is that with that space, metaphorically speaking, at least, there comes a sense of potential. It is a space to be filled. Not, of course, that we could, you know, literally, on the subatomic level, fill ourselves. That would be, I don't know what that would be. That would be very strange. But just that idea that with this potential, you know, with all of that space, what is in it? You know, it's not just empty space. It is fear and it is misgivings. And this is a moat around us just as much as the space on a subatomic level is. Just as, you know, in the first stanza, that moat that I was talking about becomes metaphorically the river Styx. All of these things, all of these barriers between us, and you know, that kind of gets resolved towards the end of the book, which we'll talk about a little bit more. For those, you know, while you're sitting there and I've put you asleep, why do living things bury themselves? I'll go ahead and tell you that this was my attempt to write a dense poem, and I wanted to write a dense poem that wasn't necessarily indecipherable, I think is the word that I'm looking for. As I mentioned before, most poetry today, I don't really think too much of it, because Russell Baker, I actually wrote the quote down so I could have it for you verbatim. Russell Baker said, I gave up on new poetry myself 30 years ago when most of it began to read like coded messages passing between lonely aliens on a hostile world. And I found that quote and I went, you know, amen, because most poetry these days, you read it and you have no idea what the person's talking about. It's like, for example, The Wasteland, and not that I'm comparing any of my stuff to The Wasteland, my God, I would be on something, but for the example, The Wasteland, you read The Wasteland, at least this is how I look at it. I read The Wasteland for the first time, and I knew that I was missing it, you know? I knew that I was like, there was a lot there, but I just wasn't getting it, but in addition to that, I understood that I wasn't getting it because I just wasn't getting it. I did not have the faculties. I had not, you know, I don't know if anybody can ever fully get The Wasteland. They haven't read everything in the English language like good old Tom had done. But, you know, I knew that I could come back to it over and over again and learn more from it. Whereas, you know, these days, it doesn't matter what you bring to the table. You don't know what the poet's trying to say to you. So I wanted to try to find some middle ground between, you know, a poem that you could work at and understand. Again, like Eliot's Four Quartets, you read it and you have to work at it to completely understand what he's talking about. So this was kind of my attempt to do that. I think to some degree that I succeeded, and I'll give you a quick key because, again, I don't want to give out footnotes for these things because that would just, you know, why inflict that on the regular populace? But the main thing that I started playing around with the idea of in Living Things, and also later in Requiem, which we'll talk about here in a second, is the idea of resurrection. But not just resurrection, more like reincarnation. That this was a good thing. I mean, well, you know, assuming you believe in reincarnation. But if you know anything about it, it's supposed to be theoretically a good thing. You do good things, you move up the karmic ladder, and eventually you reach, you know, Nirvana, which is where you go to Pittsburgh and you hang a left. But But you eventually reach enlightenment. But I thought, you know, wouldn't it be interesting if that was just a gag? I mean, what if you can't get out? What if you're just trapped in this cycle and you, you know, no matter how many times you go through the door, you can't go back in. You have to go all the way around again and start over. And so, you know, you might get sick of the cycle and decide that you can't return to dust fast enough. So why do living things bury themselves? Because they're impatient and they want to get it over with. Anyway, that's a quick thing about that poem and my basic take on it, which will hopefully give you some kind of insight to take back to it if you needed some before. And, you know, maybe you've got a better interpretation of it than mine. Please let me know what it is. I'd love to hear it.